You can trust him. Plistarchus shook his head and said to me, The fact is, if you and Marcos continue to blunder about as you have, if you make a mistake, it could start a war and thousands will die. It was so similar to what Pericles had said that Diotima gasped. Plistarchus noticed her reaction. The Spartans fear Athens, young lady. That's not something I'll admit in public, but the Spartans fear your democracy. If it spreads, what will happen to the Spartan way of life? Some demand war at once, before Athens becomes stronger. The Ephors are among those for war. Others hold that it is none of our business, as long as Athens does nothing to upset the balance in the Peloponnese, which is ours by right of strength. I understand, Plistarchus, I said, and Diotima nodded. Plistarchus said, Do you Athenians know what the hippis are? It means cavalry, knights, I said. So it does, a title of great honor. The hippis are elite soldiers, the best of the best. In war they're our scouts, trained to act independently. In peace, the hippis are the royal bodyguard. Many cities have a similar system, I said, wondering why Plistarchus told me this. This much all men know, he went on, that they are scouts and bodyguards. But the knights of Sparta have a third job, one of great importance. A third job? Don't these people have lives? No. Combine the first two tasks, and what do you get? I have no idea. In war, the knights gather information about the enemy. In peace, they guard the state. Diotima said in surprise, Men who gather information to protect the state? Plistarchus nodded. The knights are Sparta's security service. He paused. Marcos is one of their best. Which made Marcos the best of the best of the best. Suddenly, I felt less confident of victory. Marcos smiled at me. Surely this is no surprise, Nico. My job is much the same as yours. I wager we have the same skills and the same expertise. Except I was a sole individual with little or no support and no official position, forced to live by my wits and reliant on the largesse of Pericles. I noticed King Plistarchus showed not the slightest surprise at Marcos's revelation about my own profession. Obviously, Marcos had reported on me to King Plistarchus. Plistarchus continued, Now as to what I'm about to tell you, you have sworn never to reveal. Not under any circumstances. Then why tell us? Because if I don't, you will probably die. It sounded like a good reason to me. Within Sparta there is a tradition, closely kept, which we call the Crypteia.
The secrets?
Just so. The Crypteia is a rite of passage for Sparta's most promising young men from across the entire army, the ones likely to become officers. They're sent alone into the countryside with only a dagger, no food or water, and orders to survive without being caught.
What if they're caught?
The failures are beaten to within an inch of their lives. There's no place in our officer class for losers. That made my own army training look like a picnic. Plistarchus said, Each young man is required to kill a few of our slaves, the people we call helots. It's our way of getting the young men used to killing before they have to do it much more dangerously on a battlefield. I looked to Marcos in astonishment. You did this? You murdered a helot for practice? Marcos shrugged. It's what we do. But it's not murder, Plistarchus said. Every year, at their inauguration, the Ephors declare war on our own helots, so that it's legal to kill them at any time. Oh, well, that's all right, then. It's been this way for centuries, Nico, Marcos consoled me. If it makes you feel better, we only target the troublemakers, who would have gotten themselves killed sooner or later anyway. Plistarchus went on. A few of the young men, the ones who demonstrate unusual aptitude at the helot-killing part of the test, and who are judged to possess the personality to match, are recruited by the Ephors to join a secret organization of the same name, the Cryptea, the Secrets. When something unsavory has to be done for the good of the state, the Ephors turn to the Cryptea. Like the Hippus, the Cryptea serves the state, but where the Hippus exists to secure the state in the light of day, the Cryptea works in the dark to... Eliminate problems? I suggested. Just so. I don't understand what's happening, Nikolaos, son of Sophroniscus, but when you tell me the Secrets killed Arachos, you are probably thinking of hidden information, but it might mean something quite different. I asked, Does Arachos have anything to do with this? Marcos said smoothly, Arachos was neither a knight nor, as far as we know, a member of the Cryptea. He was just a big oaf who was good at hitting people. Marcos is offensive, but correct, Plistarchus said. Arachos was an outstanding, if slightly dim-witted, warrior. A fine man in the ranks, but not officer material. Now he's become an excuse for war for those who want it. If there's any danger of you exonerating the Athenian, it will be cause for war. So if I saved Timo, who was only one man, then many thousands of men might die in battle. Terrific. Diotimus said to King Plistarchus, Why don't you simply ask this Cryptea organization if they're involved? And if they've acted without orders, why can't you simply order the Cryptea to stop whatever they're doing? The Cryptea wouldn't obey me, even if I knew who they were. You don't know? As I command the Hippus, so the Ephors command the Cryptea. They're entirely different units within Sparta. Only the Ephors know the members of the Cryptea. I won't risk open conflict with the Ephors, neither here at Olympia nor back at Sparta. When you three walk out of this tent, you're on your own. Are Scarathos and his friends Cryptea? Marcos said. I should hope the Ephors have better taste than that. But who knows? Surely, Plistarchus, I said, the Ephors would not dare challenge the authority of the kings. Plistarchus snorted. This wouldn't be the first time the Ephors have acted against the kings. Why, my own grandsire. He trailed off. Diotimus said,
King Pleistarchus, would a Spartan assassin really kill another Spartan? And if so, why? This is hard to believe.
Then I must take you to someone who will convince you. Someone who, frankly, I'd rather avoid.
Who's that, sir?
Pleistarchus shuddered. My mother. Pleistarchus departed to arrange the interview. I said,
Quick, Marcos, what do you know about Queen Gorgo?
Daughter of one king, wife to another, mother to a third, he replied. Gorgo's been the power behind the kings of Sparta for three generations. They say she's the smartest woman in Hellas.
A likely story, sniffed Diotima, who had her own pretensions in that area. They always make these claims about royalty.
Well, you're about to have your chance to find out, Marcos told her. A guard came, and we were escorted, Diotima, Marcos, and I, to the tent of Queen Gorgo, in the very center of the camp. I would never have guessed the tent contained royalty, for it looked like any other. The Dowager Queen of Sparta sat within upon a hard wooden chair, the only concession to comfort an upright back. A guard stood at attention behind her, and it wasn't merely for show. The man looked ready to kill the slightest threat. Gorgo was so thin I could count her bones. Her hair was tied back and gray, which exposed the outline of her skull. The image was accentuated by perfect teeth that seemed too large for the rest of her. Her hands were like the claws of a bird. Her dark eyes had the look of an alert and merciless eagle. Gorgo noticed me, and I felt like some bug crawling underfoot. She said,
So you're the ones they say are causing so much trouble.
I waited for Marcos to defend us, but when he stood silent, I replied,
I think the one causing the trouble, Queen Gorgo, is the man who murdered Arikos.
No need to get uppity with me, young man. I said that's what people in Olympia are saying. I didn't say I agreed. My son tells me you need to know about the Cryptea.
We asked the question, I said. An anonymous note claims secrets killed Arikos. Pleistarchus thinks it might refer to the Spartan Cryptea, but there are other interpretations. Would the Cryptea really murder one of their own citizens? And if so, why? Especially since, except for his ability to fight, there was nothing special about Arikos.
Nothing special, Gorgo repeated, then said. There's one thing about Arikos, but I cannot conceive of it as a motive for murder. Did you know that the father of Arikos was one of the 300?
Marcos told me.
His father fought and died at the gates of Thermopylae, alongside my husband, Leonidas. After the war, I personally made sure that the children of the 300 were cared for. If anyone harms a child of the 300, it's as if they harmed my own. You understand?
Yes, Queen Gorgo.
Tell me what you know.
I did. It was the first chance I'd had to explain to Marcos the anonymous note on the Ostracon and its strange message. He exclaimed when he heard it. I finished by saying, And so we want to learn whatever we can of this Cryptea.
I see.
Gorgo was silent for a long moment. Then she said,
There's a family history.
Yes?
My father, Cleomenes, was a king of Sparta. My father, how shall I put this delicately? My father went stark raving mad.
That's delicate? I asked the queen of Sparta.
I'm known for speaking my mind.
Insanity is sent by the gods, Diotima pointed out. Usually to punish.
The Dowager Queen examined Diotima head to foot, like an officer examines a soldier.
You are?
I am Diotima of Mantinea.
Diotima lifted her chin proudly.
Your accent says you're Athenian.
Yes, Gorgo. I go by the name of my mother's city.
I could tell Diotima was favorably impressed by the way she stood a little straighter, as she would before a high priestess. Gorgo said,
You're right, Diotima of Mantinea. Insanity is the curse of the gods. In my father's case, in the war against the Argives, he dragged prisoners from a temple sanctuary and cut them to pieces.
I winced. That would do it. To abuse temple sanctuary is almost the greatest crime there is.
So the gods cursed my father, and his condition worsened until the family had no choice but to put him in chains. Can you imagine the shame? A king of Sparta in chains. Then one day soon thereafter, they found him dead.
Gorgo sat up even straighter, if that were possible.
The official story is that, while still chained in his cell, my father obtained a knife from the helot who was set to guard him. My father used the knife to skin himself alive, beginning at the shins, and laid his own flesh in strips beside him all the way to his thighs. When he was finished, there was only the meat and muscles and veins. The feet he left. I don't know why. It made the sight all the more horrific. To see those normal feet at the end of legs with the meat hanging off.
Gorgo shuddered, her first sign of humanity.
Then he started on his groin. I won't tell you what he did to himself there. He died as he sliced the last of the skin from his stomach.
This is terrible,
said Diotima, truly shocked.
The moronic god claimed my father had threatened him if he didn't hand over the knife. I didn't believe his story. I insisted the fool be executed.
You said that was the official story, I prompted.
Your stress on the word is correct. My father was mad. I don't deny it, but he wasn't insane enough to strip the flesh off his body with his own hands. My father's condition was an embarrassment to the Spartans.
Gorgo waved an arm almost dismissively.
Something had to be done. I suspect something was done. I have no proof, but I believe he was killed, and the death purported to be his own act. The Crypteia are the natural suspects. You asked if the Crypteia could kill a Spartan. They could. They'd even dare to murder a king.
I said, None of this explains why the Ephors or the Crypteia would target Arachos. The motive escapes me. Gorgo laughed, without the slightest trace of humor.
You're the ones who asked the question. It may be, as you suggest, that these secrets are not Spartan ones.
Arachos spent an unusually long time on his own, out of Sparta, on account of his athletic prowess.
She thought for a moment, then said, I don't know if it's relevant, but I talked to him last year, after the games at Nemea.
Yes?
He was very unhappy with the result. Well, who wouldn't be? He came in second.
Second's better than last, I said.
In a war, second is last, and Spartans don't raise losers. Arachos seemed to think there'd been cheating. I put it down to anger at losing.
Thank you for telling us this, I said.
There's no requirement to thank me. I do this purely out of self-interest.
Her expression didn't change as she added,
I'm an ill woman. Soon I will depart for Hades, and there's no telling what those idiot men will do without me to guide them. I need to engineer a period of peace while I still can, but this investigation threatens to destabilize all of Hellas. I need you to find a solution that gives me a chance to keep people calm.
That seemed to be what everyone wanted. The problem was, everyone disagreed on what constituted the right solution.
And if we find Timodemus did kill Arachos?
Diotima asked.
What will you do then, Queen Gorgo?
Cheer on my men as they lay waste to Attica.
I nodded automatically. This was the wife of Leonidas, who had led the 300. She had watched and waved to her own husband as he marched off on a suicide mission. The Queen of Sparta would do whatever had to be done.
Are there any of these Cryptea at Olympia?
Diotima asked.
If there are, I'll discover it and let you know.
How? Marcos asked. He probably thought that if he couldn't find the answer, then no woman could, not even a queen.
I have my sources, young man, and they're not for you to question.
Marcos bowed his head.
The head man at Athens, who is it these days?
Gorgo asked.
Athens is a democracy, I said at once. We're all the head man. No one's vote counts for more than anyone else's. No one can tell us what to do, and we share the decisions.
Don't give me that rubbish, said Gorgo. I was doing power politics when you sucked on your mother's teats.
Diotima stifled a laugh.
Now, tell me who leads Athens.
Pericles, I said, reluctant to admit it to an outsider.
I'd heard the same,
Gorgo said.
The son of Xanthippus, isn't he?
Yes.
I know Xanthippus. Not as great a man as my late husband, of course, but a good man. He would have made a reasonable Spartan. Tell me, is the son like the father?
Pericles? I was nonplussed for a moment. How would one describe Pericles?
When Pericles talks, people listen.
Gorgo grimaced.
I know the type. I wager he's untrustworthy. That's the problem with these elected rulers,
Gorgo said.
They always make short-term decisions to make themselves look good. The Ephors are the same. Now, if Athens had a king to run things, no one would be under pressure to get re-elected, and the people could be ruled well for the long term.
What if the king's not too bright? I objected.
Then they listen to me. I've advised the Spartans since I was 8 years old.
8? The Spartans listened to a child? I couldn't believe it.
What could an 8-year-old possibly have to say?
She smiled grimly, but answered in a matter-of-fact tone.
I advised my father, the king, not to invade Persia, which he was considering. It was my first move into foreign policy. One of my better decisions, too, if I may say.
I'm impressed, Queen Gorgo,
Diotima said.
For all your life, the Spartans have followed your advice, while I, who live in a democracy, have no chance of being listened to. How is it that you Spartan women are the only ones who can rule men?
Gorgo turned her eagle eyes on my wife.
It's because we are the only ones who give birth to real men.
Diotima looked Gorgo in the eye.
We'll see about that, she said.
There was nothing more to say. We turned to depart.
Athenian!
I stopped.
Yes, Queen Gorgo?
I like your woman. Bring her back sometime.
Marco said he had things to attend to at the Spartan camp. Diotima went to look for Socrates, whom she'd volunteered to keep an eye on and then neglected. A child was safe enough at Olympia, but she thought she'd better at least confirm he was still alive. I went straight to Pindar. Whatever had happened at Nemea, it was clear we needed to know about it. Pindar was easy to find, because the afternoon of the second day is reserved for religious rites. I found him in the sanctuary of Zeus, where he stood upon an unoccupied stone pedestal and declaimed poetry. He might have been a statue himself, the way he stood with his back straight and clutched the front of his formal chiton in a dignified manner. A small group of men and women had clustered about. He saw me, but ignored my hand waves to come down.
"Not every truth is the better for showing its face undisguised."
I waved so frantically that a respectable woman beside me thought I was a madman and stepped away. It had no effect on Pindar.
"And often, silence is the wisest thing for a man to..."
Whoa! I dragged him off his pedestal.
"My apologies, everyone," I told the crowd. "The great Pindar has been summoned."
A few muttered, but there were plenty of other attractions, and the people moved on.
"Summoned by whom?"
Pindar demanded.
"If it's anyone less than a head of state, the Furies will be as nothing compared to my wrath."
"We need to talk," I said. "I need information."
"You? You dragged me away for you?"
I led him by the arm.
"Where are you taking me?"
"Do you like to drink?" I asked.
"I'm a poet."
"I'll take that as a yes." We stopped at the nearest wine cart. Olympia was dotted with the things. They wheeled in at first light, sold wine by the cup at amphora prices, then disappeared when it was too dark to count the coins.
"What's your best wine?"
I asked the man behind the cart. He was dark and covered in warts. From the way he wobbled and his eyes glazed over, I guessed he'd been at his own wares.
"Got some from Lampsacus lying around,"
he slurred.
"Lampsacus is in Ionia,"
he added helpfully.
"Yes, I know."
I bought the wine and didn't worry about the cost. If Pericles and Pleistarchus were both so desperate to avoid a war, one or the other of them could fund me for a few cups of wine.
Pindar followed me while I carried a cup in each hand to the shade beside the Horion, the temple of Hera. We sat on a bench that was miraculously unoccupied. I said, Pindar, I have a question for you. Gorgo says that straight after the competition at Nemea last year, Aurikos complained to her. He said there were irregularities. One Eye told me to ignore rumors before I'd even heard them. This has come up too many times now. What really happened? Pindar fixated on only one point.
Gorgo?
He said.
Queen Gorgo's at Olympia? I had no idea. You want to avoid Gorgo, Nikolaos. She knows people who kill people. Lots of them.
You're too late, I told him. We've already spoken to her. She seems quite nice once you get past her innate feelings of total superiority. He rubbed his chin.
Her feelings are well-founded. I do have great regard for both her and her glorious husband. I viewed the battlefield, you know, before the bodies were buried. I never saw such carnage before or since. But one thing I can tell you, every Spartan who died sent 100 Persians to Hades before him.
There was something I'd always wondered about that most famous of last stands. Tell me, Pindar, is it true you wrote the epitaph for the 300? Passerby, go tell the Spartans that here, according to their law, we lie. They were the best-known lines of poetry in the world, but no one who'd been present when the memorial stone was raised had ever claimed the credit.
I'm not going to talk about that,
Pindar said without hesitation.
The late, great Simonides and I were both on the mission to praise the fallen. We agreed the deeds of the heroes were greater than the words of any poet, and swore never to reveal the author. It might not even have been either of us. Other poets were there too.
The way he said it, I knew this was a rehearsed line that he'd repeated many times. I wasn't surprised. Everyone wanted to know who wrote those lines. It told me something else about Pindar. For all his massive ego, the man was a patriot.
Gorgo's contribution to the war was as great as her husband's, Pindar said. When the Persians gathered their army to invade, a Spartan then exiled in Persia sent us a warning. The Persians would have stopped him, so he had to write in secret. He scratched his invasion alert on the backing board of a wax tablet, which he covered over with fresh wax, and then sent it home. When an apparently blank tablet arrived in Sparta, none of Sparta's so-called wise leaders understood the meaning. They took it to Gorgo. She deduced at once that there must be a secret message, ordered the wax removed, and so read the warning to prepare for war. We'd all be Persian slaves today if it weren't for her clever deduction.
Let's get back to the unpleasantness at the Nemean Games, I said.
Why ask me?
He evaded. Because you're the one who first mentioned it, just before the chariot race, I said.
You'll have to ask the ones involved.
Nothing escapes the eyes of the famous Pindar, I wheedled. A little flattery wouldn't hurt to deal with a man with an ego the size of Pindar's. I need to see through your eyes, brilliant Pindar, because you see what other men miss. Surely the greatest poet since Homer would notice the subtle relationships between men. Who hated whom? Who was jealous? Who was plotting? Come on, Pindar, greatest of bards. Tell me what really happened.
Good gods, man, are you trying to butter me up?
His tone was angry. Yes.
Listen, flattery will get you nowhere with me. I lay it on thick with honeyed words better than any man alive. I could teach you tricks of sycophancy that would make your eyes water. What do you think it means to be a praise singer?
Pindar stood and drew himself up to his full height to announce.
I, Nikolaos, am a professional flatterer.
He sat down again.
So don't try to cozen me with your amateur efforts. It would be like attacking a well-armed Spartan with a blunt knife.
He looked me up and down before adding,
a very blunt knife.
Pindar drained the cup again. It was my plan to loosen his tongue with wine, but I was starting to wonder how many amphorae it would take. I took the cup from his hands without a word, so I could be ripped off by the wine cellar for a third time.
I hope you're sober enough to answer questions, I said when I returned.
You asked about Nemea?
He burped.
Your friend Timothemus had an easy run to the final.
He paused, no doubt for dramatic effect.
A remarkably easy run. Every single man Timodemus faced, he disposed of in short order.
Timo's good.
No one's that good. Pretty soon everyone noticed that all the other bouts were fiercely fought, but against Timodemus, it was as if his opponents lay down for him like weak women. I wasn't the only one to notice. Accusations were made. Of cheating.
Cheating happened. Men didn't like to talk about it, but sometimes two pancratists would arrange a result in advance. Then money would change hands. Pindar continued.
The judges of those games looked into it. The only problem was, if he'd bribed his opponents to take a fall, then every single man must have been involved.
Were they?
Every one of them stood before the altar of Zeus at Nemea and swore there'd be no arrangement. In truth, it's hard to see how Timodemus could have suborned everyone. The judges decided there'd be no bribery. They swore every man present to secrecy that the question had ever arisen.
Then how come you know about it?
I was present at the swearing, as a witness. The judges wanted someone who could report later that all had been done according to the law.
Pindar had begun the conversation with the claim he hadn't been involved. I decided not to point out his obvious lie. Perhaps it was an attempt to be discreet, as his position required. Pindar said,
the judges concluded that collusion was impossible, but no, that wasn't the end of the matter. There was another explanation.
What was it?
Witchcraft.
Nico, do you think it could be true?
Diotima asked. I found Socrates and Diotima at her tent, where we'd agreed to rendezvous. She'd searched for my errant brother and bought sweet cakes along the way. He'd been willing to go with her because, as he put it,
the chariots were fantastic, but not enough people get killed in the athletics.
Now we nibbled on the cakes and discussed the revelation that Timodemus really might have cheated. To curse an enemy is so simple and easy, anyone could do it.
I don't know, I said, glum. A few days ago I would have laughed. Now I'm not so sure.
I'm sorry.
She put a hand on my arm. This was why a man wanted a wife, for comfort.
There were too many good reasons for Timodemus to kill Arikos, she said. to silence his taunts, to silence his accusation that Teemo cheated, or maybe even to cheat.
I winced.
I know he's your friend, Nico, but I have to tell you.
Yes, I know. 3 days from now, I'll stand before the judges to condemn my own friend. Did I tell you, by the way, One Eye demanded I bring the trial forward?
The man must be mad.
Merely willing to sacrifice his own son to reflect in Olympic glory.
Diotima, you're a priestess. This tale of witchcraft, is it possible? Oh, Nico, priests and priestesses don't do magic.
Magic is different?
Completely, utterly. If 100 people want to honor the gods together, then someone has to perform the sacrifice. Someone has to say the prayers. Someone has to pour the libations and clothe the statue. They can't all do it, so the priestess does it for them. That's all being a priestess means when you get down to it. But curse magic? That's asking the gods to hurt someone to your advantage.
How?
The curse is always written on a tablet.
Pindar didn't say anything about curse tablets. Where would you look for one?
Down a well? Most curses invoke Hades, Lord of the Underworld, to do something nasty to the victim. The closer you can get the curse to Hades, the more likely the god is to read it. Most people scratch it on a strip of lead.
That must be bad for the well.
It's only lead. It can't hurt you. Also, if you hire a professional to write your curse, it has more chance of working.
Did Teemo know any magicians?
You said anyone could write a curse tablet. True, but a professional magician knows what to write and how. Magic is all about persuasion. No one can coerce the gods, no matter what some charlatans claim. Mortals can only ask and hope the gods feel charitable that day.
Does Timodemus know any magicians? I have no idea. I doubt it. If he has been writing curses, what would they say?
Diotima picked up her wax tablet and scratched some words, which she handed to me.
I call upon Hades, he who rules in the land of the dead, to whom all men must go, to bind my opponent Arachos in the Pancration. May his arms grow weak, may his strength wane, may his hands fail to grasp, may his legs grow heavy and his knees fail. Do this for me, mighty Hades, Lord of the dead, so that Arachos loses miserably, and I am victor in the contest.
I put it down in shock. This really is cheating. Timodemus would write one of these before each fight,
Diotima said.
He'd name his opponent and say what he wants to have happen.
Why not write one generic curse? May all my opponents lose. Something like that.
Because it's very unlikely to work. The gods need a name to work with. If you wrote something like, "Please make me rich," would you expect wealth to arrive at your door?
No.
Right. It's too general. You're asking the gods to do your thinking for you. The gods aren't nannies looking out for us. But if you said, "Please, Poseidon, make sure my merchant ship makes it to Chios this trip," then you're in with a chance. He may or may not do it, but at least Poseidon knows exactly what you want.
I see. If the priests and priestesses don't do magic, how do you come to know all this?
People beg priests and priestesses for an effective curse all the time. You're not the only one to make the confusion. After a while, I became interested and looked into it. You know how it is.
With Diotima, I certainly did. She absorbed knowledge like a sponge. She went on.
But this can't be the answer, Nico. Arakos didn't lose in a contest. He died in a forest.
In fact, if Teemo had cursed Arakos, then he wouldn't have needed to kill him, I said.
Strange as it may sound, if we can prove Teemo cheated, then it might just save his life. Let's say Timodemus cursed Arakos. Where would he put the tablet here in Olympia? There's no well. Everyone gets their water from the river.
In the river, then?
Too shallow and too easy to see.
Dig a hole?
Wouldn't that be obvious?
Dig a hole in the woods.
If he did, we'll never find it.
I nodded glumly.
If we can't find the tablet, it means nothing. Merely that we couldn't find it. Of course, you don't have to find the tablet, said Socrates. He'd been uncharacteristically quiet.
What do you mean? I demanded. Of course we do.
But, Nico, if Timodemus planned to curse his opponents, doesn't he need a lead strip for each one?
Socrates said.
Diotima said so. All you have to do is search his tent for the other lead strips.
Diotima and I looked at each other in despair.
I hate it when he's right, she said.
We burgled the tent of my best friend at once while the games were in full swing and there were few around to see us. If Timodemus had belonged to any other city, it would have been a problem. Strangers walk into an empty tent, questions are asked. But Teemo was an Athenian, and the men of the neighboring tents had seen me before. We didn't even have to sneak in Diotima. It was forbidden for women to view the contests, but the tent camp was fair game. We left Socrates on guard outside. I ignored his bitter protests and went in. There was a camp table in the middle, the kind an officer might take with him on campaign. A camp bed lay along the far side. I tested it. Quality stuff, well strapped and made of solid wood. This thing was heavy. How did they transport it? Oh, yes, that explained the long line of donkeys tethered outside. The tent seemed extraordinarily well-appointed. Because he traveled to so many contests, he lived under canvas more often than any man but a military officer. He needed the comforts to keep his body in condition. Though I'd known him all my life, I'd never thought of this before, and Timodemus didn't like to talk about himself. Diotima had unrolled a bundle of papyrus sheets on the small table, using her palms to prevent the sheets from curling. She frowned as she read.
"What do you have there?" I asked.
"Love poetry," Diotima said.
"Teemo reads love poetry?" I said, aghast.
"I don't know about reading, but he certainly writes it."
She looked up at me.
"And it's very, very bad."
"Give it to me," I said, intensely curious to see what my best friend had written. I grabbed the pages.
"No!"
Diotima snatched them back before I could see a word.
"I can't let you do that, Nico. It's personal."
"Then how come you're reading it?"
"That's different. I'm a woman."
There were no curse tablets, nor strips of lead, nor an engraving tool to inscribe into the lead we didn't find. There wasn't even anything to write with.
"This is awful," Diotima said. "I was so sure we were on the right track."
"I'm relieved," I admitted. If Timodemus had been practicing witchcraft, what would I have done? Diotima understood. She hugged me.
"Timodemus might have hidden his curse equipment somewhere else," she said.
"In this crowded place?"
"Buried it in the woods, maybe? What do we do now?"
I said,
I want to look into the tent next door,
where One Eye and Vestiano slept.
Why?
Diotima was puzzled. There's a demon on my shoulder, whispering in my ear. The tent of Timo's father and uncle was barely furnished. Two camp stools, two camp beds, two traveling chests pushed together in the center of the space to make a table.
Where are the books?
Diotima asked at once, perplexed. The tent was far too utilitarian for her taste.
I don't think they're the reading sort.
Diotima looked at me as if such a thing was beyond her comprehension, which it was. For her, the marks that men made were a gift of the gods, and only the sacrilegious ignored them. Diotima was one of the few women who could read. She read so often, she could even do it without having to say the words out loud or move her lips, a level of expertise few men ever achieved. I opened one of the chests, Diotima the other. Within mine were jars of ointments, leather gloves like the ones used in boxing and for practice, spare clothing, expensive and well used.
I'll bet this one belongs to One Eye, I said.
Diotima rummaged through hers.
Nico, I found a wooden case.
She pulled out a box, wide, deep, and flat, the sort of thing in which you might carry paper writing tools. It was the right size. She hefted it.
It's too heavy to hold papyrus,
she said, following the same thoughts.
In fact,
she said, and gave me a meaningful look.
It's heavy enough to contain lead.
She jiggled the box. Something inside rattled.
Open it!
Diotima pressed on the lid, but it wouldn't open.
There's a catch!
I tried to take it from her, but she pulled it close to her chest.
Oh, no, you don't. Finders keepers.
She ran her fingers around the edge, probing.
Ah!
She pushed a tiny lever. I heard a click within. Diotima slowly lifted the lid while I crowded close to see over her shoulder. Lying within, in neat rows, were vials. They were ceramic, in a nondescript red with no decoration, and each stopper tightly.
What are they?
I asked. Diotima picked one up and, keeping her thumb over the stopper, she shook it. Something sloshed. She removed the stopper.
Careful,
I warned her. Diotima took a gentle sniff, then a longer one. She screwed up her face in distaste.
What is it?
I asked.
I'm not sure,
she said.
But I think this is hemlock.
We hurried back to the closest private place, my own tent, with the evidence in hand, and pulled the flap closed behind us so we could inspect the booty. Diotima had developed a new theory, that Arakos had been fed hemlock.
All right, I said.
Tell me how Uncle Festianos persuaded Arakos to drink it. You think Festianos went up to Arakos the Spartan and said, Here, old chap, there's hemlock in this cup. Quaff it off like a good chap, would you now?
I don't think so.
We don't even know for sure this is truly hemlock.
I'm sure it is, Nico, said Diotima. Everyone knows hemlock tastes like a dead mouse.
Do they?
How could anyone know such a thing? I demanded.
Well, it doesn't kill at once,
Diotima said.
Anyone who's been executed with it could tell you before he expired.
Have you ever spoken to a man dying of hemlock? I asked.
No.
I could try it and see,
offered Socrates. He picked up the poison.
Don't be stupid, Socrates,
I said,
I snatched the vial from his hand. You're not to go anywhere near Hemlock. You hear me?
Yes, Nico,
Diotima said. There are doctors who use hemlock to treat patients with aching joints.
Don't the patients die?
I didn't say they were good doctors.
So, these vials might be...
medicine.
Then the whole thing could be totally innocent? How do we know if the dose in the vials is fatal or therapeutic? I asked.
A doctor could tell us if this is medicine, Diotima said. But where will we find a doctor?
I smiled. Leave that to me, I said. I know just the man.
Yes, I remember you, said Heraclides of Kos. You were in the tent when I operated on the chariot driver.
What happened to him?
He's still alive.
I'm pleased.
So am I. There's more chance I can squeeze my fee out of his father. What can I do to help you?
Diotima, Socrates, and I sat before him on three folding stools in his expansive tent. Heraclides himself sat on a chair. He was a man in his prime years, strong and healthy-looking. I suppose that was important for a doctor. Who'd trust a physician who couldn't keep himself healthy? The most unusual aspect about Heraclides the doctor was the writhing, squirming thing on his lap that he struggled to contain.
Is that a baby? I asked.
Clever of you to notice. I see you have the makings of a doctor. This is my son.
Heraclides smiled proudly.
My wife left me to amuse him while she went to the Agora.
He jiggled the creature up and down and cooed. It was obvious Heraclides was more than happy to entertain his son. We need to consult you, I said to him in an attempt to keep his attention.
Is one of you ill?
Heraclides held the baby's tiny hands, wiggled them back and forth, and went,
Coo-coo! Coo!
We aren't ill, Heraclides, I said, wondering if there might be another doctor in the camp city.
Your wife is pregnant, then?
The gods forfend, Diotima interjected. Heraclides turned to her.
I'm afraid the gods are usually uncooperative on that score, he said.
I'm not pregnant,
Diotima said with finality.
In fact, we only have some questions for you, I said.
Questions count for the usual consultation fee,
he said at once. I said, Oh, of course, being a doctor, your only concern is...
The health and welfare of your patients,
Diotima broke in.
How much for your wise and knowledgeable advice, worthy Heraclides?
She asked smoothly.
20 drachma for the consultation.
Agreed. I choked and hoped one eye would pay. After all, we were doing this to save the life of his son, whose brains might soon be dashed out on the rocks of Mount Taipeum. If that didn't count for a medical emergency, I didn't know what would.
We have this vial, Heraclides, I said.
We had brought it along inside a canvas bag to conceal the evidence. I pulled it out to show him.
Is this hemlock? And if so, is it strong enough to kill someone?
Heraclides threw the baby into the air and caught him with practiced confidence. The baby giggled and smiled. Heraclides threw the baby again, so high he almost bounced off the canvas roof.
Is that good for him? I asked.
Perfectly, Heraclides said. Babies enjoy the sensation of flying. It's because the throw takes the baby closer to Apollo, who is a god of healing and health. The theory is perfectly sound, I assure you.
Why do you ask? My mother says babies shouldn't be tossed in the air. An old wives' tale. My mother's a midwife, I told him. Is she now? In that case, here, hold the baby for a moment, would you?